Greetings, I'm your host Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. So glad to have you guys here with us live, and of course happy to have the people that will be checking out this later on audio only formats. As we said before last night on the show, if you listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, then you can have access to the Champagne Room if you sign up and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. You can have access to the Champagne Room. I won't say past and present because that's a lot of Champagne Rooms to upload, 3 years worth. I don't know if I'm up for that. I don't even know if I have all those on file. But before we start, if you're new to the channel, please hit like, please hit subscribe. Don't forget to hit that notification bell so you're alerted whenever we go live. Got to start the evening off with an RIP for Terry Funk, WWE Hall of Famer. Shout out Terry Funk. So sad. Earlier this week, we had guest host Billy Button fill in for me and discuss the life of Clarence Avant, aka the Black Godfather. Thank you again to Billy for filling in. If you guys haven't seen it, Billy was a guest on Pop Life. There's a playlist for that show on the TIR YouTube, so make sure you check that off. And Billy also has his own YouTube channel where he does broadcasts a couple times a week. There should be links to that in the description as well. If not, I'm sure one of the very, very skilled moderators will put that in the chat. Yesterday, I got to do a show with Derek Varn, and I call him like Jay Leno of TIR. He always is a great fill-in when I'm not around. Kenzo Shibata and I talked about the Satanic Panic of the 1980s and why it is still relevant today. As always, thank you to all the subscribers on YouTube and Twitch and all the other formats. Of course, thank you to the patrons. Collectively, you are the fuel and the engine that keeps TIR moving along. If you're enjoying what we do here and you do want access to Champagne Rooms past and present, be part of the live virtual audience for the Pascal Robert hosted Mau Mau Hour. There's only one way: become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year. It can all be yours. And also, you get to join us for our movie nights. Now, all that being said, let me bring in our guest for today. You know him as the co-host of Left Reckoning. You know him as a sometime columnist for Jacobin. You know him as, you know, a real deal Texan. I'm wearing a Texas shirt today because I challenged Griscom to a cowboy shirt off some time ago. He thought I was effing around. It's not a game. Please welcome David Griscom.
Hey, how's it going, brother?
How are you?
Man, I feel I feel like I didn't show up prepared. I'm wearing H&M.
Hear that? What kind of that's some Austin shit right there?
Probably.
You know, no one in Midland is wearing H&M.
I bet you people in Midland are wearing H&M.
We can go to Midland right now, and it will be. The sad part is, I think we're about the same distance. That's how big Texas is. Like me. I have made that drive, by the way. It's really long. Midland to Austin, that is. How's the weather? Is it scorching hot?
It's hot as hell, man. I mean, it's been, we didn't hit 100 yesterday, or no, 2 days ago, which broke a streak here of, like, I think 47 days over 100, which is a record by a lot. Hopefully, by the way, the power stays on. Because we're on kind of emergency situations in Texas right now with the grid, which looks like we're very close to capacity right now. So everyone is, I have my AC turned up. It's hot as hell in my house now. So ready for this win.
I do have some questions about that. I thought we were going to have John Salazar, who came on last week, and we talked about immigration and the Texas U.S. border. I know when I spoke to John, he was actually driving from Austin to the border. So I don't know if he's dealing with one of those outages as well. But I am keeping an eye out to see if John is able to hop on. He was really stoked about joining the show and talking to you. I told him, I got another text in John. He's from Austin. John was all excited. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Texas. Last night, I know many of you were watching the RNC debates, and people watching or listening to this show were probably watching people watching the debates. But however you slice it, the GOP is the party of conservative reactionary insanity. My co-host Pascal Robert was a guest last night on the Katie Halper show and did some play-by-play on those goings-on. And he, like me, felt like the current crop of GOP hopefuls might be to the far right of Donald Trump. But what does that all mean? We've said on this show many times that more and more rights that had federal protection are being rolled back to the states. Take abortion, for example. Texas has been on the forefront of anti-abortion bills, becoming a hellscape for women's, gay, and transgender rights. What's the matter with Texas? And is Governor Greg Abbott acting like a king ruling over his own fiefdom? Or is he just echoing the sentiments of the people? David, I know you're one of in the more liberal parts of the state in Austin, but how are people outside of the Capitol responding to Abbott and what's currently happening in Texas?
I mean, you know, across the board, I think you got to note a couple things about Texas is that, you know, while we do have a conservative majority, you know, it's a state that doesn't look, despite what a lot of people claim, that it's going to flip to the Democratic Party anytime soon. The way that the Republican Party right now has been operating, like primarily coming from Abbott, is really out of step with most Texans' opinions on like these hot button issues, right? Things that, you know, people do have strong opinions on. And, you know, but you look at something like abortion, like what you just talked about, if you look at polling in Texas, people aren't very supportive of like a effective, like outright ban, like which is effectively what we have at this point. You know, there's a little bit of a, you know, an area, like what level, what stage do you support abortions? But like what we're getting in policy is not very reflective of even what conservative Texans want. And you can go across the board on that, from gun policy, economic policy. More and more, the Republican Party in Texas is operating like on the fringes even of their own base. And I think a large part of that comes from the fact that you know, the Texas political system is very skewed in one direction, which means that there's only one real force when it comes to being a threat to your reelection campaign. And that is going to be the far right part of the Texas GOP primary voters, right? So a very, like, if you think about the entirety of the population of Texas, and then you think about the people who vote in the GOP primary, we're talking about a sliver of those folks who are making a lot of noise and getting listened to. But I think, too, if you spend too much time like fixating on the voters, you miss what's going on behind the scene. And I'm sure as like we get into some of like the other issues, you know, go into a little bit more detail. But, you know, I mean, this state is like captured by private interests. Like, look at what's going on at the border, right? You think about the horror of it, the brutality of it. But there's a lot of money to be made, right? There's a lot of money to be made. Operation Lone Star, which is Abbott's like mobilization of the Texas National Guard to the border, all of these kind of stunts that you're seeing, you know, there's people who are outfitting these state troopers. I'm sorry, these the National Guardsmen. There are people who are furnishing the wire. There's people who are, you know, getting contracts with the state to do all sorts of things. And it is very much like unregulated and unchallenged politically, and people are, you know, walking away with significant millions of dollars. And it just so happens a lot of these guys tend to be major donors to Greg Abbott's reelection campaign, or, you know, which we could talk about maybe more in depth later if you want to, you know, what's going on in prisons right now. You know, most cells in Texas, nearly 70% of Texan cells do not have any kind of air conditioning, which means
that's heavy.
It's horrifying. And in the past 3 months when we're in this, you know, the thing is always funny. It's like Texas is a hot, you know, it's a hot place, right? We all get that. But there's a difference between, oh, this is a Texas summer, it's hot, versus what we've been experiencing now. You know, we in Austin, we just broke a record 47 days, over 100 degrees, unprecedented. You know, the previous marker was something like 25, 26 days, right? So significant increases in heat. And, you know, it's brutal what they're doing to these prisoners, but I also think that it's important to remember that there's money to be made, you know, just like on something simple, like bottled water. They've increased the prices on how much they are charging inmates for bottled water by 50% in the past month.
Jesus.
Right. You know, so like, yeah. I think it's important to recognize that there's like the brutality and the cruelty and all of that kind of stuff. But there's also just so much money to be made by some of these really nefarious actors in the state, too.
Now, I do want to talk a little bit about private interest, because I'm not totally sure about how your guys' power grid works. 2 years ago, there was a big freeze in Texas that laid bare the failures of the state power grid. Another scorching summer that you're speaking about is putting more pressure on that grid. I know California gets a lot of justifiable grief about rolling blackouts. But what's going on in Texas at the moment with the power grid situation? Because before we even, like you hit me up earlier today, actually John also said the same thing about possibly facing a power outage. I'm assuming it's because of everyone's air conditioner being on.
Well, I mean, it's because, you know, you have high, I mean, again, it's, I have like a little thermometer on my computer. It's 98 degrees outside right now and the sun just set. About 20 minutes ago, right? So it's hot, even like, you know, going into the evening, going into, you know, after the sun sets. And this is when a lot of people tend to be at home. So you typically get more power usage as the day goes on. And also what happens is two things that are, you know, large in Texas, power generation, wind and solar. Well, you see what happens when the sun stops shining, right? You get that kind of pressure. And when it's hot like this in particular, the wind isn't really blowing in West Texas. So that creates a kind of crisis where we're not able to produce as much electricity as needed for the state's, you know, vast, you know, growing population, growing economic activity. I should say that, you know, throughout the summer, there's been a few of these. This one seemed to be the most threatening. We'll see, like this next hour will probably be the kind of make or break moment. You know, but it, like, regardless of if it goes out or not, I mean, just the fact that, you know, we're in the energy capital of the country and in a lot of ways, the energy capital of the globe, we struggle to keep the lights on. I mean, that doesn't speak well to the way that the system works in this state. And, you know, there's a few things that like are notable about Texas's grid. I think people know the first one, which is that Texas is not, at least the vast majority of Texas, there's a little bit of West Texas, the El Paso area, which is connected to the national grid. But ERCOT, which you know is the power supervisor for the majority of the state, is not connected to the national grid. And they did that because they did not want to be under federal regulations for our power system. Sorry?
Is it awesome?
Yeah. And again, like, and I, 100%. If Texas is connected to the national grid, probably Uri doesn't happen. And that was the winter storm where, you know, a lot of people died. And I think it's important to like highlight that for folks. It wasn't just like a massive inconvenience and painful and difficult for people. People literally froze to death. And, you know, the same kind of threats, obviously, when it's hot like this. You know, so obviously, if we're able to pull in power, that can solve a lot of the, you know, a lot of these kind of problems of maybe blackouts. But I also know that the power grid to the east of us and the north of us that sort of services people from Louisiana up to Minnesota is also under tremendous stress because of climate change. And I think that sometimes people focus too much on the fact that Texas isn't connected to the national grid. Like I 100% agree we should link up with the national grid, but the Texas system is so fundamentally broken because it's one of the like most over-marketized power systems in the country. Basically, what you have is you have this constant auction house And compete, like the idea is like, oh, if you have a bunch of competition, then the system will work better. Well, what that ends up actually meaning is that these private corporations, in their kind of competition, are sort of hoping that other people fail. So during Uri, why does that happen? What happens? Because it got historically cold in Texas, and a lot of the natural gas pipes froze over, right? So a lot of people were no longer able to produce power. But of course, Texas, you know, as much as we might think it is sometimes, you know, doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? There's other places that it does get cold. And well, what do you do there? You weatherize those systems. And plenty of people have been saying that Texas is very, is due for, you know, extended periods of cold like we experienced under Uri. And they've been saying, hey, we need to weatherize these systems. Well, most of the power companies said, you know what? It doesn't make sense for us to spend the amount of money that it would cost to maybe go offline for a couple of days if something like this happens. One, because, you know, in the grand scheme of things, they're not too worried about that. But two, as for the power companies that were still producing power during Uri, said, you know, one of their CEOs said, you know, being able to produce power during Uri was like holding a lottery ticket, because it's a completely deregulated system, which means you can charge people astronomical prices for electricity. Texans, particularly people who are don't have, like, so in Austin, we have Austin Energy, and a few other cities still have like those more municipal kind of public-private relationship power systems. But for people who are on that pure unregulated market where you can choose your provider, right? Mm-hmm. Those people were getting bills for thousands of dollars after Uri. And this summer, everyone's experiencing the same thing. My electricity bill is massive right now. You know, so like when we talk about the blackouts and all these things, it's super important, but there's just like a kind of fundamental day-to-day problem here is that electricity is too expensive for most people. We have a lot of waste because the system is not set up with the goal of providing power and electricity to people. It's set up with the goal of creating as much profit for the people who own those power generation facilities.
I mean, that is literally what we saw in California in the early 2000s with Enron. And, you know, I don't know if you remember that whole story. And of course, a lot of that takes place in your home state.
I was about to say, you're welcome.
The Texas-California relationship keeps on. It sounds literally like what was going on. And I don't know if you remember the executives laughing about the little old ladies that were calling in about the $1,000 electricity bills. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this had to do with the deregulation that was happening under Bush Jr. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that, is it Epcot?
I wish. No, it's ERCOT. ERCOT. Oh,
sorry. Wrong bad guy. And ERCOT, what regulation would they have to abide by? Just pricing regulation?
Federally? Yeah, I mean, I'm not like an expert all the way on energy policy, but basically Texas's like market system that we have is unique nationally. And I think there are certain kind of requirements that the federal government sort of puts on you that they wouldn't be able to do. Because basically what it is there's like an auction house constantly for electricity producers in the state of Texas, right? And it's like a almost automated system, right? It's like a pure market. I mean, it really is like a capitalist wet dream in something which, by the way, like power production is one of those kind of systems where it doesn't actually make very much sense to have a market, right? Dropping even like our maybe more typical issues with, you know, the whole system in general, you know, it doesn't make sense, for example, to have competing lines going into the same area, right? You want to be able to produce power at scale, which means being able to produce a lot of it at once, right? And as people know, like economies of scale, being able to produce more power is better generally for cost, right? So having a bunch of like private hands and private producers on the market doesn't necessarily lower the price for most people. And that hasn't been the experience of the vast majority of Texans since we deregulated our system. And like California and like a lot of Western states, like Texas is used to have a much more publicly, you know, it wasn't perfect, don't get me wrong, but a much more kind of publicly oriented utility system. And we deregulated around the same time as California, I believe, in like the 90s and 2000s. You know, so this was something that is like a development of the neoliberal turn. And it's meant that our systems are much more archaic. and that they're just irrational. They're fundamentally irrational in the ways that they're able to produce power for people. Again, like, it's just like, it's really ridiculous to be sitting in a state that produces so much energy and to struggle to keep the lights on. It's a free for all. And you have natural gas, producers, you have wind and solar. And you know, the one system, nuclear system that we have, Comanche Peak, is up there in Dallas, but like, it is a system that's very much like a kind of Wild West, pure free market system, and it's prone to these kind of failures. And it's something that, you know, like going back to like the national grid thing, right? Again, it makes perfect sense Texas should be connected to the national grid, but Texas is a big state with a massive population, and there are countries that are able to produce their energy needs at the scale that Texas does, right? That you would maybe compare to Texas, that don't have like the luxury of like the United States to connect to, right? So it is something that like absolutely that would solve some of the problems, but it really can't be an excuse at this point. And ERCOT is very much connected to Greg Abbott, as you can imagine, right? So ERCOT is like the agency that oversees this kind of free market chaos. And, you know, the people around it. So basically, like, what kind of reforms happened after, after Uri? There was some kind of toothless requirements that companies need to weatherize their systems for both heat and cold. And natural gas plants have failed multiple times this summer because of the heat. So there was some toothless stuff that they put in, right? It's things that are like very easy to get around, fines and things like that, that just aren't going to fundamentally change the system. And a requirement that people on ERCOT need to be residents of the state of Texas, right? Because people are very mad that one of the people who was on ERCOT during Uri was from Michigan, like is from Michigan, and wasn't a resident of the state of Texas, right? So like kind of toothless, silly, symbolic things. And Abbott is supposed to have limited interaction with this system. I'm forgetting the exact mechanism of how everybody's appointed, but he has overstepped his role in ERCOT and has basically been through like back channels telling them exactly what he wants them to do and how he wants them to interact with these major producers. It's another example of like, one, the failure of neoliberalization, but also the kind of crisis that's coming out of the centralization of political power in the state of Texas in the seat of the governor.
Now, so there's no oversight committee over ERCOT. It's just ERCOT.
The government's supposed to oversee ERCOT, and ERCOT's supposed to oversee the private producers, right? But the problem is that the government isn't very interested in doing it. Most of the people who are getting into positions of power on ERCOT or positions of influence are either sort of loyal or are sort of under threat from the government. Because, you know, like energy is a big deal in the state of Texas, obviously. It's a big deal anywhere, frankly, and it's something that socialists, we should be thinking about a lot. But again, like there's so much money to be made in this broken system. And again, like there's parts of it that are irrational and like mismanagement. But as we were saying earlier, it's like there's people made insane amounts of money during Uri. People are making incredible amounts of money this summer when we're being told, hey, you got to put your AC up to 82, 84 inside to make sure that the electricity doesn't go out for, 30 plus million people.
And who is suffering?
When
these deaths happen, I followed it a little bit. I'm not going to lie and say I followed it super closely. Who is suffering? Is it usually the poor? I know when the storms hit, there's a certain part of certain parts mm-hmm. of Texas that really get destroyed. So I'm assuming the same thing is happening when these power outages are happening, or when the freeze happened and people literally died in their homes.
Yeah, people who are suffering, rural people suffer when the power goes out.
People, like the hinterlands of the state,
100%, right? Who supposedly the GOP is supposed to represent and fight for, and you see that from this to the rural hospital closings in the state of Texas that they don't do very much for them. The people were freezing to death in their cars trying to heat themselves up. So yeah, certainly a lot of poor people were suffering during Uri. But also like one of these things that is just like a constant point of stress, and I wish the Democrats would hit harder on, is that your electricity bills are going up, right? Like, I don't use a lot of electricity. I don't live in like a big ass home. You know, my electricity bill has gone up to something like $280, $300 a month, right? Which is a significant increase from even what it's been, you know, in previous times. That's tough if you're somebody who's living on a budget. That's tough if you're somebody who's working minimum wage. You know, so like this system, when it fails, it becomes a deadly situation for people because they either can't cool themselves down or they can't heat themselves up. But there's a kind of everyday squeeze and bleeding that people are experiencing where they are having to shoulder more and more of a burden to pay for these profiteers who are making the state less safe and less efficient.
I mean, this sounds kind of frightening. Frightening. I understand and what also, you're saying.
I want to say it's like this is coming everywhere. I mean, like our ability to be able to produce enough electricity for society is really suffering as climate change. Because what happens with climate change is that, you know, most Texas homes traditionally are sort of meant to keep heat out, right? So that's why those winter storms are so rough, because most places are sort of designed to keep people cool. But all across the country, right? You see what happened in Oregon, you know, just a couple years ago when they had this massive heat wave. A lot of those places don't have air conditioning. You know, people were baking and dying in their homes in Oregon. And like our ability to produce power and then to be able to utilize power in efficient ways that, you know, keep people, you know, in safe climates for life. You know, this is something that's happening everywhere, right? Remember the wet bulb that hit a bunch of parts of the South recently? Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that like your body literally is unable to cool itself because of the humidity and the heat in the air so that you can overheat really, really quickly. You know, so these are like fundamental questions that we on the left like need to be thinking about and like fighting for public power, like not just like as a climate change issue, absolutely, but also as a basic human rights issue. Like, you know, electricity should be something is like we have the technology to produce electricity cleanly and efficiently and at scale so that we don't have to be suffering like this. The problem isn't so much the technology. It's the cost of building those things out. We have a government that's afraid of doing that and a government that's very, you know, committed to making sure that there's always some guy who can make a buck off of something as critical as electricity in the 21st century.
And it sounds like on the backs of very poor and working class people that can't afford it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as someone that's driven through Texas more times than I can count, and I understand the differences in climate from Beaumont to, you know, El Paso. And I live in a concrete house with no insulation. Mm-hmm. Like you said, it's made to keep you cool. It doesn't get that hot here in the summer, and it doesn't really get that cold in the winter, but still, it was a little colder than usual. And then there's no central heat here. So I can only imagine what people are dealing with when you have things like snow. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you guys had was it 2 years ago when that winter storm hit that you guys just weren't prepared for.
You know, the houses aren't prepared for it. People aren't prepared for it. You know, and like, you know, there was a real moment, like, you know, my mother was telling me about how, you know, she was checking in on neighbors and people who didn't get, because, you know, there was, of course, like people started running to the grocery store when all this happened, right? And there's kind of panic. Some people who didn't have vehicles that could handle driving on those roads, you know, were sort of stranded. And my mom told her neighbors, you know, my mom lives in a very modest house, right? And she like said, you know, I don't have much, you know, but basically said, like, come to my house and just grab whatever you want. So those people grabbed some crackers and, you know, they just started crying, right? You know, it's just like that's how bad it was for some people that the state of affairs had gotten to a place where just being able to provide somebody with some snack food, people who weren't able to heat, you know, cook food if they had anything, people who might have lost food, perishables and things like that. It's a real threat. And something, again, that's like very real. And this is why it's important, I think, for socialists to understand that, like, we not only have a responsibility to trying to figure out ways to fight climate change and reduce our carbon production, but also make sure that, like, we have grids that are reliable and function and also aren't bankrupting people. Because, you know, you see these horror stories of people across the state now getting these massive bills for $500, $600, $700, $1,000 unexpected. And that's just unacceptable. It's unsafe. And it's very much like it's a basic human rights issue. But it's also a class issue. Because, you know, what I get worried about more than anything, is what are the rich doing in response to this, right? Well, the rich are building rooftop solar and things like that on their house, and I'm not against that or anything like that. But there's a kind of opt-out message that's becoming popular, right? And there's a very real threat, for example, of like the wealthy neighborhoods basically having some semblance of electricity, maybe through household solar and batteries, and then the rest of us working class people being on a dirty, failing, and a very expensive grid. And it's something that, like, is worrying, because electricity is something that it, in a sense, like, it tends to be, you know, it trends toward more democratization, right? Because it's just something we, like, all live next to each other. We all have to be on the same kind of grid. We all have to be on the same kind of system. And seeing what how the wealthy are responding to these kind of things is trying to build up their own little islands of electrical usage. It doesn't portend well for the, you know, for the future of energy policy in the state.
I mean, I see the same thing here in Mexico, and it's frightening to hear that a place within the United States is just like where I live. You know, and also too, don't just not forget, people could just leave. You know when a storm's coming.
Oh yeah, you can be like Ted Cruz and go to Cancun.
Yeah, which who was that that did that in Texas that took off the Cruz. Cancun? Ted Cruz.
And he even wore like a little Texas flag mask when they caught him at the airport, you know?
Of course he did. And it's not like they caught him and he just stopped. He kept on that flight like, oh no, I'm still going to Cancun. Yeah. Get some blankets, bitches. Like, he gave not one single solitary fuck. Now, moving along to voter suppression in 2021. Abbott passed a bill banning drive-through voting, which definitely hurt a lot of brown people in the state of Texas. And Texas is pretty brown, certain parts of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a majority minority state, for people who don't know that.
Right on. How is that affecting the situation currently with the voter suppression? Is it working?
I mean, you know, it certainly plays a role. And, you know, Ken Paxton, our disgraced attorney general, who's under indictment and impeachment right now, you know, got a lot of attention when he said, you know, we stopped millions of votes from being cast. The voter suppression in the state, how difficult they're making it to vote in the state of Texas, is absolutely, you know, it's a travesty of democracy. It's a real threat to politics in the state. And like things like drive-through voting were very popular. They were really effective. And also mail-in ballots, right? Mail-in ballots are something that particularly for people in rural Texas are really important. The irony of the rights war on voting has been that, like, they're also making life worse for a lot of their voting bloc. I don't know. Like, I think that, like, we have to be able to speak two truths about this at once, right? One is that voter suppression is fundamentally, like, it's anti-democratic, right? You're trying to pick certain groups that you don't want to vote, and you're trying to prevent them from voting. I think it's important, though, to not let the Democrats off the hook with the narrative, right? So, like, absolutely challenge voter suppression and all of these kind of attempts, because they are worried. I think the GOP, even though they're sitting pretty right now, and maybe we can talk about it later, but, you know, they're waging war on the vast majority of Texans' ability to pass local regulations for workers' rights, environmental rights across the board. But, you know, we also have to be clear as progressives and socialists to not let the Democrats sort of say, oh, Beto O'Rourke would have won had there not have been more, you know, if there had been drive-through voting or if there had been more mail-in ballots available to people, right? Because there are fundamental political problems with that party, the way they're running campaigns and their ability to take on the Republicans. And oftentimes they sort of use that as like a kind of like counterfactual. It's like, oh, if only everybody... I don't think that it's swinging elections, but I think it's a major problem, right? Because you're disenfranchising people, and that's unacceptable.
I mean, is there a pushback from the DSA or any of the Democratic candidates, or is the far right just too entrenched within Texas state government?
And pushback, do you mean on voter suppression or in general? On voter suppression, I mean, you know, the problem is just like the majorities of the Republican Party are very strong. You know, you do get some kind of fractures within the Republican Party on some of these questions, primarily from people who represent more rural areas. But more often than not, they're willing to go along with this game because they feel very confident and comfortable, particularly on the statewide map. You know, where I think the voter suppression gets really nasty is when you look at the gerrymandering in the state of Texas. I mean, it's ridiculous. I don't know if I have the time or the energy to pull it up, but like, if you want to see some of the most ridiculous congressional maps, like go and look at Texas's congressional map. I mean, they make no sense. You know, the most cliche gerrymandering where you have like one little line that goes for, you know, 50 miles and then gets this neighborhood and that neighborhood, you know, there's no sense to it other than a very clear political map. You know, Austin as a city, obviously, you know, is a place that the vast majority of people here vote for the Democratic Party on federal and state elections. But if you look at like our congressional districts, I mean, there's just like multiple little slivers that come into Austin and then have us connected to, you know, cities far out, you know, west of here, east of here, south of here, north of here, in order to try to prevent there being more Democratic representation, for example, in Congress, on in the Senate, in the House here. It's just as ridiculous. You know, so that plays a huge role in the kind of the constitution of the legislature. You know, there's a lot of groups here that have been doing a lot of really great organizing on voting rights and on voting access. But as long as, you know, the Republican Party controls the levers of power, you know, you're sort of limited to court fights. And that's kind of can be hit or miss, knowing the way that a lot of the courts are set up in the state. With, you know, conservatives.
So I was going to say, I'm assuming the courts in Texas are equally as conservative as the mm-hmm. state government.
Yeah.
That sounds frightening.
And, you know, I mean, it's tough. And like, I mean, we haven't even got to HB 2127, which is probably one of the most consequential pieces of legislation that has passed in my lifetime in the state of Texas.
You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, it is. It is Texas AFL-CIO called HB 2127, the Death Star Bill. And that's not putting it, that's not overstating it. It is one
don't
of
mind the being most, the bad guy.
It is truly one of the most egregious attacks on democracy in the state that I've ever seen. So effectively, the simple way to understand it, And the way that most people heard about it was that it was going to ban water breaks in the state of Texas, which it absolutely will, right? There's going to be some legal challenges and things like that. We'll see what happens. Maybe it gets watered down. But I think in that sort of being the national story, people miss what this bill actually does. Mm-hmm. What it does is it says local governments and county governments in the state of Texas cannot go further than state code in terms of regulation. So on things like water breaks, the city of Austin had passed a water break legislation mandating water breaks, you know, and also nothing like I mean, the bare minimum, frankly, right? Like water breaks for for people working outside every 4 hours, 15 minutes in the shade and water, right? Which you should
and
be.
This is everybody, non-union people, everybody.
This is for everyone, yeah. And Dallas passed a similar kind of protection. And like, you know, heat is a killer. It's a killer here. It's a killer everywhere. You know, companies oftentimes play fast and loose with the suggestions that you get from OSHA. So this was something that was a kind of life or death issue for a lot of workers. We've seen multiple deaths this summer of workers who've died of heat exhaustion. You know, so it's absolutely an important struggle. But what this bill does is it expands beyond that. So that means, you know, environmental regulations. So something like banning fracking in a city. They're blocking the ability to do that. Passing other kinds of environmental regulations. Passing certain kinds of housing regulations that contradict state code. Those are prohibited. And what it does, you know, so there's a whole host of basic things that the government should and could do to sort of deal with, because the cities in the state of Texas, you know, have tended to be more Democratic over the past few years, despite the state map being very hostile to the Democratic Party. So it prevents the ability of cities to be able to pass their own kind of legislation. And it's a response to the success of a lot of progressive organizations in the state of Texas. So in the most recent election cycle, a lot of states decriminalized marijuana. They banned certain kinds of tactics and techniques by the police that are truly abusive. And the GOP took note of that and basically tried to prohibit those activities. Not only does it prohibit those kind of things, it gets rid of immunity for elected officials. So typically, if I was a crazy right winger, right, and I wanted to sue the city of Austin for doing something horrifying, like giving workers water breaks, you would sue the city of Austin, right? And it would go to the courts and, you know, the lawsuit would go through there. Now, you could actually sue individual council members and hold them personally liable for this, right? Which puts a lot of threat under these elected officials, you know, who already are difficult sometimes to work with in some cases, right? There are some notable exceptions, but you know how it is working with any Democrat. Not only is that a threat, but the jurisdiction of those lawsuits is incredibly wide. So you can sue from any county that is touching the county. So like if somebody wanted to sue, you know, a city council member in Austin, they could do so from Hayes County, right? They could do so from these areas that are much more Republican and hold the legal proceedings in that county, right? Which would more likely than not be a much more hostile place. So it fundamentally shifts, you know, politics in the state. And it comes on the back of tremendous success of a lot of Texans realizing that, you know, while the Texas Democratic Party continues to fail to challenge the Republican Party, you know, cities hold a tremendous amount of power and influence, and that might be a viable way to make a better life for workers. And it's a threat to the GOP, you know, in a few ways. One, this is a threat of a good example, right? So if workers working in Travis County or in Austin have better conditions, aren't suffering under the heat or, you know, whatever. Well, you know, you don't want to have something right next to your Republican county, you know, that is showing a kind of a different way forward. And also, despite the way that most people think of Texas, according to the most recent U.S. Census, 90% of Texas lives in what the U.S. Census calls urban areas. So this is like a direct attack on the ability of the vast majority of Texans to be able to pass laws that they see fit. It's one of the most egregious assaults on democracy that we've seen in a long while. And that's a tall list in the state of Texas.
Does it feel like to you a war on Austin and Houston? What are the big cities? Austin, Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, and
all of them. Then Texas, you know, passed the Medicare for All. Like, you know, it's symbolic, but like support for Medicare for All, right? Cities across the state, you know, decriminalized marijuana. 100%, it's a war certainly on Austin, Houston, and Dallas and San Antonio, but like the vast majority of Texans, right?
Yeah, and it's because they've seen how successful a lot of these progressive organizations who got smart, predominantly like using things like ballot initiatives, right? So even if you have a Democratic Party that is kind of bought out or unwilling to fight for people, man, we can put a question on the ballot. Most people want marijuana decriminalization. Most people want workers. The water breaks were passed by the city council. But, you know, you get what I'm saying. Like most people, these are common sense policies that most people can get behind. It's a threat to the GOP. So that's why, they came at it. And there's, you know, they're willing, the GOP is willing to push into that gray area. You know what I mean? Like they're willing to sort of push politics to this extreme, which is why it's so ridiculous when you see how spineless a lot of the Democratic Party is in this state.
I mean, it feels like Texas is kind of the far right victory lap, maybe Florida as well, that, you know, religious right who got into state legislature in both those places. Maybe it's the victory lap they run because they're kind of getting their way with some ludicrous laws, a lot of culture war stuff. But what we're talking about here isn't just, you know, CRT and taking, history of slavery out of school books. You know, we're literally talking about the life and death of the citizens of the state due to, you know, kind of, I don't even have a word to describe the management of people like Abbott and DeSantis when it comes to being governors. I mean, if these people run for president, it seems like you could just throw this out as you know, the failures of their tenure as governors. But in the very small amount of the RNC debate that I saw, it sounds like everything you're saying is in line literally with what these people were saying on the debate stage about what they wanted to do away with teachers' unions. They were a problem. There is no climate change. Unions in general are a problem. And it just sounds like Greg Abbott is kind of towing the quote unquote company line. That's why I asked the original question. Are there people in Texas that agree with this that aren't?
I mean, there certainly are, right?
I mean, I know you don't just talk to anybody with a hammer and sickle on their t-shirt when you're walking down the street in Austin.
You know, I mean, like the problems of the problem is that the Republican Party gets to frame the vast majority of the debate in this state. Like even on like HB 2127, right? The bill I was just talking about. I mean, it is, if you look at the text, if you look at what it's going to do, it is just like a very clear assault on, yes, democracy, but also again on 90% of Texans who live in urban areas. You know, how does the GOP frame it? You know, they frame it as a stay in your lane bill, right? You know, for common sense policy in the state of Texas, because we don't want so much red tape. So, you know, we don't want to be too difficult on companies to be able to deal with the bureaucratic state. So they should be able to operate the same way in one county in Texas as the other. Right. And when you let them frame it in that way, one, this is absurd. You can argue against it, but you can't let them sort of frame it in this way. It's like, oh, well, you know, this is a classic Republican Democrat debate, right? Do you want more regulation or less regulation, right? Because then you sort of miss the entirety of what the actual function of that debate is, right? The function of that debate is to strip millions of Texans from their ability to do self-government. The Republican Party, you know, has been able to deliver for members of their base, right? Even if it's symbolic, right? They get to say, oh, they're coming against woke capital and all these kinds of things. And like the major effects, right? The people who they're truly serving are major corporations, right? There's been attempts to create special courts for corporations, right? Because everyday judges can't, you know, rule. The judges that you and I would stand before, you know, don't understand corporate law. So they need their own special court, right? And of course, with good relationships with the governor of the state of Texas. I'm like, I have a lot of hope, you know, in Texas and in this country for a different kind of politics, right? So that's why I'm not going to be one of these kind of people who comes up here and says, oh, Texans are just naturally conservative or reactionary. You know, that's just the way it is, right? I don't think that that's the case. When you talk to most people, you know, you see that there is a kind of understanding that, hey, you know, workers should be protected, that people deserve dignity, things like that. There are antisocial, nasty folks, people who are cheering, for example, what Abbott's doing at the southern border. That is 100% a reality. But I do not believe, and I do not see it in my life, that that is reflective of the vast majority of Texans. The problem is that when we sort of boil down people's political opinions or try to conceive of like what the minds of millions of people are solely by the results of elections between two parties, which have shown time and time again that they're not interested very much in working class people, that, you know, you can sort of miss what is actually popular with the vast majority of people. And people do want to have a government that like fights for workers, right? That protects them. And like, yeah, sometimes you gotta, you know, you might have to be sensitive about what kind of language or buzzwords you use. But like, for example, like even within the union movement here, Ryan, you can read his article. We've interviewed him on the show. Ryan Pollock is an organizer at the IBEW, and he got the Texas AFL-CIO to endorse a Green New Deal and a just transition. And I don't, you know, you don't need to be an expert on Texas politics to know that a lot of people in the Texas AFL-CIO work in oil and gas, right? You know, and they did that by speaking to people's common interests and the reality of what life is like working in the oil and gas industry in the state. And it's the same as it's everywhere. It's brutal. You get these promises of a lot of money and potential and social mobility, but a lot of people get left behind. And people experience that directly. For example, when the price of gas plummeted during the COVID pandemic, I mean, those were the first people on the chopping block, right? So, you know, it's tough. I mean, I wish I had like an easy answer, like one quick trick to fix and save Texas. But I think it's important to recognize that our political parties do not represent us, and the vast majority of Texans are non-voters. And that number has grown. And there was a really interesting interview done by Texas Monthly where they did something that a lot of reporters don't do, which is talk to non-voters, right? And, you know, despite the kind of common perception of non-voters, oh, these people are ignorant, they don't understand things, a lot of those people supported things like, you know, wealth taxes or you know, taking a more pugnacious position against corporate power, and a lot of things that like we support. But you know, like, I'm sorry, you can't sit here and say that like Beto O'Rourke represents that, right? Because he doesn't. You know, so like, yeah, it's bad that, you know, the Republican Party is in power, and it's bad that people vote for him. I'm not going to sit here and say that it's not. But I think that it's important to not get yourself into a trap into thinking that, oh, because they're rejecting the Democratic Party, that means they're rejecting our kind of politics, because you can see, you know, examples of you know, these windows and opportunities. And the thing is right now is like, we're up against a hostile state government in the sense of the Texas GOP, but also like a hostile Texas Democratic Party. You talk to people who have tried to run progressive campaigns, grassroots campaigns in this state, they have to deal with an extremely hostile state party. You know, and it would be bad enough if the party was just hostile, friend. They're also incompetent too. So even if you can get through the hurdle and be the person with your name on the ballot, you then have a party that is oftentimes sort of working against you or not giving you the resources that you need to succeed. Beto O'Rourke, right? Again, not a radical. He basically had to build the Beto O'Rourke campaign from the ground up. You know, and that was something that he did. And there's a lot of things in the, as much of a critic of O'Rourke, there's things in the O'Rourke campaign that I thought were good, primarily his every county strategy. The idea, like, I'm going to talk to people in every county in the state. I'm not going to say, oh, this is a Republican area, right? I think that's
a hell of a mission. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was good. I mean, the problem was that, you know, what he was doing and saying there wasn't always the best. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be tough. And like, again, like, you know, you look at Austin, we've had a lot of success with getting more progressive people elected to city council. It hasn't been perfect, right? Obviously, not all these people are radical socialists, but there's been a shift there. San Antonio has two DSA members on their city council who have been doing a lot of good and fight there. Houston has had a lot of successes. Dallas is, I mean, across the state, there are these kind of openings. But I think, you know, a few, like, the problem is right now, state level, there's not a lot of appetite from the Democratic Party to do something different than what they've been doing. I mean, Ted Cruz is going to be up for re-election. There's going to be a primary. We'll see. I don't want to write anybody off, but it looks like the person who the Democratic Party here is trying to push is this guy, Colin Allred, who was a former linebacker for Baylor. And I think he was drafted by the Titans. Yeah, you know, he's a congressman.
He keeps emailing me.
He what?
He keeps emailing me.
No, well, that's the thing. They're going to raise a lot of money. Like, if I don't want to foreclose anyone else maybe beating him, right? We'll see. But it seems very clear that the Democratic Party here is trying to set this guy up to be the guy. And they'll raise a bunch of money. They'll lose, right? But, you know, it fills the bank accounts. That's like a big problem, too, is that now that there's so much energy, I think national level, to be like, oh, we're going to flip Texas. It's a piggy bank, you know what I mean? To get out of state donors to donate to these parties and these campaigns here, even if they're not very viable or have a good strategy. Well, for trying to win.
That seems to be the one thing. It was the reaction from these abortion bans caused people to kind of lose their minds in more bluer areas, right? California, New York, Chicago. People really, really. We're like, we have to stop this. You have to stop it. We need to donate so we can stop it. And for me personally, it kind of showed that that's the one thing the GOP missed on was the abortion thing, because that definitely gets a lot of people out to vote. Kansas learned that lesson. Mm-hmm. You want to get people out to vote, you know, scare them about reproductive rights, and that seems to be the one thing. Have a super chat, and I want to ask this before we wrap up. Before I address the super chat, I just wanted people to know, as a person that lives on the border, please don't think that brown people are bringing fentanyl in from the border. You can literally just walk across where I live and buy all the fentanyl you want, and people do it every weekend. Every weekend downtown Rosarito is filled with fentanyl buyers.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus. We have a super chat from JB, and hold on, and a phone call coming in. Caller, what is your name? Where are you calling from? It's my son.
Oh, how's it going, friend?
David Griscom says hello. What do you say, Phoenix? He said hi. Give me 1 second, Feeny. Okay, thank you. We have a super chat here. Can David speak on the national and state Dem treatment of Jessica Cisneros?
Yeah. I mean, it's awful, right? This is somebody who was up against it from the very get-go. I mean, the National Party, while they're talking about abortion and how critical of a fight that is, showing up and stumping for Henry Cuellar. You know, and what she lost, right, by something like a couple hundred votes, right? So I don't think that you can say that though that putting the thumb on the scale doesn't play a role. And like, for what purpose? It's because they don't have the confidence that somebody who is progressive is going to be able to beat a Republican. You know, and I think that that's a really dangerous game, particularly the game that the Democratic Party in the state of Texas is playing in South Texas is dangerous, because all that you are seeing is, and we didn't even get into this, and I know we don't have time to, but there's this fantasy, oh, the demographics of Texas are going to change, the politics are going to change. But as I know you talk about, and you know, in different circumstances on this show, the idea that like Black people or Hispanic people are always going to be Democratic voters is just not true. You have to do politics. Not
true. Yeah. You know, as so I'm seeing a shift here in Mexico, I'm seeing more Trump bumper stickers here in Mexico.
I mean, it's frightening.
It's very uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable. But look, I know it's getting late where you are.
Can I have one last thing really fast? Just on the abortion thing, in relation to like Kansas and things like that, you know, because we did, you know, while you saw like successes for the Democrats in some areas where they didn't expect it because of abortion, I think that's right. In Texas, you didn't see that. And I think one thing that's notable to maybe compare Texas and Kansas is that in Kansas, they actually had the ability to vote on that as a single line issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right here, it's tied up to the whole Democratic Party project, which makes it much more difficult.
David Griscom, he talks about Texas and he has some good points. You can catch him on Left Reckoning. You can catch him live when we do our live shows.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Which, you know, we talked a little bit about. We won't get about talk about it on air, but I definitely want to do one in Austin and really upset the apple cart, because I'm always looking for trouble. So
my family lives here. We got to be polite. Very likely they'll be there, so we have to be on our best behavior.
Best behavior. I wear my best cowboy shirt. David, thank you so much for hanging out with me. There is a kindergartner that has to tell me about his first day of school, which I sadly missed. David, thank you again.
Yeah, take care, friend.
Everybody, we will be in the champagne room shortly. We have to get the rundown on kindergarten gossip. Who's popular? Who's got the hot backpack and lunchbox combination? Is there anybody cute in my son's class? I don't know. I have to find all this stuff out. These are the tough questions that I have to find out while you guys are waiting for me to get in the champagne room. MT will join me in the champagne room, and we will do what we normally do. We'll open up the phone lines, and we'll make fun of hip hop. So thank you, David. Have a good night, everyone. I'll see you guys in the champagne room, and we are up to